Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Okay, hit it.
Places to go, things to do, people to see. Hey everybody, it's Kyle. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. This is Tuesday. It'd be the big show, the deep dive edition into a single topic. Today, something we used to talk about a lot before everything happened, you know. We're going to do some climate change today.
Yes, because it turns out it's still changing. Changed. and I mean, it remains the existential threat that it ever was. And as it happens, while everyone has been dealing with lockdown, navigating unemployment, trying to figure out schooling, any of the other trying to, you know, deal with your own health or, God forbid, a death in the family, any of the crises that 2020 has dealt us, it just so happens that a lot of the regulations that were put in place to fight climate change are disappearing. The Trump administration has removed auto emission standards, opened up more land for oil and gas drilling, gotten rid of air pollution standards. In fact, the New York Times has been tracking this and determined that out of 100 environmental regulations that have been targeted, 68 have already been removed.
I wonder if they got the one from yesterday about getting rid of limits on methane leaks at oil and gas pumping sites. I wonder if that one's in there because
I wonder. Maybe we're up to 69.
Anyway. Yeah. That's right. Anyway, so on the pod today is Kendra Pierre-Louis. She is a climate reporter, used to be with the Times, actually currently working at Gimlet on their podcast called How to Save a Planet. Kendra, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Scale of 1 to 10. How bad is the damage that the Trump administration is doing to climate protections?
I would put it currently at a 4. It really depends on sort of what a lot of the things that you've pretty much laid it out pretty clearly, which is the Trump administration has been kind of openly targeting environmental regulations in a way that overall increases levels of pollution, both climate pollution and just pollution sort of generally, and often at a cost to taxpayer dollars. Sometimes it's not even things industry wants, which is somewhat confusing. And it all seems really bad, but a lot of these things can actually be reversed, depending on either the choices the administration makes if they get reelected or if, you know, a new administration takes over. A lot of these things are still in, in process or, even the auto emissions rollback, for example, right? Like the Trump administration made the decision under President Obama, they made the decision to increase fuel economy standards to something like 54 miles per gallon by 2025. The Trump administration rolled that back and saying that it was going to lower it to only 40 miles per gallon. But just this week, Honda, Volkswagen, Ford, BMW, and Volvo were like, we don't care what the Trump administration says. We're going to follow California standards because that's what we want to do. California has stricter standards, which the Trump administration is also in the process of rolling back. Like officially they've revoked it, but that is tied up in court. And 13 other states, including Colorado, New York, Oregon, follow California standards.
So you're saying partly it's a 4 because this is, as are many things in the Trump administration, a lot of sound, but not a lot of impact yet?
I would say we're not yet feeling the impact. I wouldn't say it's a lot of sound. Gotcha. Like these are things that have followed the regulatory process and like 4 years down the line, if they're still in place, we would really be strongly feeling those impacts, but they're just, these regulations have just passed in many cases. And so we're not yet feeling its full impact.
What if we do? Then what are we? 1 to 10.
Once we do, we're hosed, right?
Gin is an excellent climate proof alcohol is all I'm going to say.
Straight to the darkness.
Oh, man.
Do not pass go.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Okay. Anyway, Kai, please continue.
I want to pick up something you said just right there about the automakers. Part of what's going on here is that market forces don't really care what the Trump administration does, right? Coal use is declining. Renewables are climbing. Electric vehicles are becoming more popular because people want them. And I mean, there is no small amount of that being mixed in here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you hit the head on the nail on the head with when you talked about coal. Like, the reason coal is being eliminated is not because of regulation. It's because natural gas is cheaper and renewables are increasingly even cheaper. And so there just isn't really a market for coal for the most part. And even the coal providers will say that, admit that, you know, like, it's not like a big secret. But what they can do is sort of drag out that death march, I guess, to make it last longer. And if they do that, there are significant environmental implications for that. So it just practically doesn't make sense to kind of drag this thing out that the market, as you said, is saying it doesn't actually even want.
How much does it matter? You know, it is interesting because there are the market forces, and then there's also this sort of growing realization, I think, by a lot of companies that climate change and extreme weather as a result of climate change are risk and have to be assessed as business risk. Mm-hmm. Like, does it long term, will it matter if, you know, this particular administration is making sort of what it considers to be politically expedient moves that are anti-climate change, if the entire business community and the rest of the world is like, yeah, no, sorry, it's here and we're going to deal with it?
Mm-hmm. It does, because it's kind of like whether or not, I mean, if you're a business and you're trying to make these changes, right, it helps whether or not the government is actively helping you or hurting you, right, in that process of trying to make these more sustainable choices. And we know every unit of CO2 or carbon dioxide that we emit is one, you know, it has a proportional level of warming. So every day of delay has consequences down the line that, you know, like what we're feeling now in terms of like the crazy hurricane season that's been happening this year, the wildfires out west, I can't even say that word, the crazy windstorm out in Iowa, you know, like everything that we're seeing.
Yeah.
Thank you. Those are the impacts of emissions that were emitted 30 years ago. That's not what we're, you know, what we're putting in the atmosphere now is dooming future generations. So it's kind of there's still time to act. I mean, I wouldn't be working on a podcast that's focused on solutions if I didn't believe that there was still time to do something, obviously. But we can't delay. What I often equate it to is a speeding train, which is, you know, there's a tipping point and there's a point at which that train is going to hit that wall. If you don't pull the brakes, the train is going to hit that wall. And we're rapidly kind of hitting that tipping point, but we still have time to put on the brakes.
Let me ask you a two-part question about this pandemic. The first part is, it was really good climate-wise back when nobody was driving, right? And then part two is, we're all just so distracted with working from home and kids trying to learn and just the psychotic insanity of being trapped in the same four walls for so long. I imagine we're losing focus on climate change, right?
So to the first part of your question, it did reduce emissions temporarily. And as I alluded to earlier, like every unit emitted is great, but it didn't reduce emissions anywhere near the degree that we need to reduce emissions to rein in climate change. And I don't know anyone sort of in the broader climate community that thinks the way it happened was good. None of us were cheering for the pandemic. And then the other question you're asking is, we're sort of losing focus. I think yes and no, because we're in a weird space right now. And this kind of happens every summer. Pretty much, I think, since like 2017 was kind of this tipping point where we start having so many climate calamities or climate-linked disasters that you can't not pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. We're on our, 12th named storm of the year. You know, like, even if you're not paying attention, it's now at a point where it's an imminent risk to your well-being in many cases. And so it becomes more poignant and more present. And, you know, I was pleasantly surprised that they even mentioned it last night during the DNC. It was a brief mention, but that's a shift. You know, like the fact that it was even brought up the first day of the DNC was huge to me. I wish they talked about it more, but that's a separate conversation.
You were listening more closely than I was because it went right by me. I didn't even hear it. So that's interesting.
Bernie brought it up. Yeah.
I cheered. Yep. Bernie brought it up. And I was like, yes. To what extent do you think is the pandemic? I read a story today that basically was like the school reopening conversation that we're having now around the pandemic is a preview of what climate change could bring. And frankly, a repeat of a conversation that's happening right now in Bangladesh, where like a third of the country is underwater. What extent is this pandemic the warm-up act? for what we're going to have to deal with and are having to deal with already.
Yeah, I wouldn't call the pandemic a warm-up act. I would say that it's an apocryphal tale, right? Because the thing that, as someone who lives in the United States but has friends that don't live in the United States and has friends that are in countries that looked at the pandemic and what was coming and made different choices, and now they get to live a regular life, more or less. They get to go to school. They get to do these things that we're wrestling with. The reason we're wrestling with these kind of catastrophic decisions of having to keep children at home continued is because we didn't deal with the issue when we could have. Like, we could have, they're just so, like, this wasn't an, you know, you look at South Korea, you look at Taiwan, you look at Vietnam, you look at Germany, you look at New Zealand, you look at Australia. Like, there's so many other countries that did it better than we did it. We made a choice, and that choice was to extend the misery of millions of people. And that's the same with climate change. We can make choices both around reducing greenhouse gas emissions so that we don't have to deal with the worst effects of climate change and decisions around adaptation. So what do we need to live in a world that we know is already warming? And we're not making those decisions. And so in that way, I think there it's less a preview and more parallel that if we want to be able to live in a world that can handle climate change, we need to be making different decisions.
Mm-hmm. So I truly do not mean to be the downer, but I'm going to be. You said you had hope and you wouldn't be doing a podcast about solutions if you didn't have hope that there would be progress made on this issue. Nothing you're saying makes me believe that people in positions to do anything about it are doing anything about it. Same with the pandemic, frankly.
Yeah, but, you know, the interesting thing about—
In the United States.
In the United States, right.
But look, we're the biggest economy in the world. We're the 800-pound gorilla in the global economy. You know, I mean—
Yeah, but
what we do matters for now, anyway.
I don't mean to be like very dark, but yeah, but maybe not for long. Like, that's the thing. Like, the reason we're the global economy is— or, like, such a key part of the global economy is because of decisions that generations before us have made, right? Yep. And we're not necessarily continuing to position ourselves in ways that seem to suggest that the world wants to play nice with us, right? Like, how many countries are currently letting us into their borders?
Yeah, not so many.
I mean, I do wonder, I think to sort of reframe that, that is ultimately the question. Like, what happens if the United States continues on a course that doesn't address the very real threat of climate change? Like, how much does that affect our long-term economic prospects in addition to our health and safety, of course?
Yeah. I mean, it obviously, you know, there's a bunch of, you know, policy analysis that's sort of an economic analysis that looks at this, and it hurts our bottom line. Like, how many— we've had so many billion-dollar disaster years in the past 10 years. Like, these are not cheap mistakes, just like financially. And then there's the human impact of this. I talked to doctors who worked with patients who survived the 2016 floods in Baton Rouge, you know, and these are children. And every time it rains, the school children were freaking out because they thought it was going to start flooding again. There are long-term psychological consequences to dealing with extreme, you know, natural hazards. So there's that element of it. And then there's the fact that, like, one way in which the pandemic is very different from climate change is, by and large, the decisions that the United States has made in regard to the pandemic has mostly affected the United States. That is not true with climate change, right? It's a global problem that requires global coordination and global solutions. And so we are being bad actors. And it's a real question how much longer the rest of the world is going to put up with us.
Kendra Pierre-Louis is a climate reporter at Gimlet for the How to Save a Planet podcast. Thanks so much, Kendra.
Thanks, Kendra.
Thanks. Normally, I swear I'm more cheerful.
No.
What? Oh, no. That's not what we do here.
Really?
Yeah, we don't do cheerful.
Oh, my goodness. Thanks a bunch.
Cool.
Thanks a lot, Kendra. Take good care.
Bye.
Yeah, look, it's lousy. It's lousy.
I know.
It's a lousy topic.
Careful viewers of our podcast will know that, in fact, it's so hot in Oakland today, I had to put my hair up in the middle of the podcast, which is the least of the problems that will occur as climate change worsens and are occurring. But I mean, I think the ultimate point is, like, it is increasingly obvious to everyone. And if anything is going to drive change, I hope it's that. On this topic, we want to know how the pandemic has affected your habits when it comes to sustainability, or more importantly, what are you thinking as you experience the climate changing around you? You know, are you one of the people in California who's putting in backup power because we can't rely on the grid? Are you, I don't know, are you hardening your home against 300-mile-an-hour winds? Tell us what you are doing to try to adapt to the changing climate and just your thoughts on this episode overall. Send us an email or a voice memo to makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we'll be right back.
All right, news. We're going to do a little news. What's on my mind? What's on Molly's mind? And then what's on all y'all's mind? I will go first. It's a quickie. It's an update to the item I brought to the Daily Pod yesterday about the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, deciding pretty much spur of the moment to shut it all down and send everybody home, and we're going remote. Here's the deal. And this is from a local weekly newspaper in Chapel Hill. Turns out, and it goes back to the conversation that we had with Scott Galloway, here's the quote from the paper. The announcement was made on Monday afternoon around 3:45, less than 2 hours before a 5 p.m. deadline for fall tuition per the registrar's office. After August 17th, withdrawal refund was reduced to 80%. Come on, man.
Yep.
It's just so cynical. It's just so cynical.
Let the lawsuits begin.
Come on.
I mean, that is really...
It's just
cynical is a really nice word for that, actually. Yep. Yeah. You got kids sick and potentially their parents. Yeah. And then you screwed those families out of refunds. Like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hear lawyers salivating right now.
Yeah, for sure.
Totally. Speaking of all of this in a roundabout way. Speaking of Congress not acting, I was thinking, like,
yes.
It's too bad for them that the liability shield that the Republicans want is not in place. But as you know, Congress has failed to manage to get some kind of relief out to American consumers. Walmart today issued, I would argue, a little bit of a warning, because even though Walmart reported absolutely bonkers earnings, and the second quarter was like all stimulus spending all the time, Walmart said, hey, we definitely noticed that as these checks ran out, spending is starting to drop. Tapered off in July as shoppers spent the money that they had. So FYI, Walmart being a little like Horton Hears a Who right now. It's a little who on the purple flower.
No, that's right. So the theme of these two news items is, gosh, who could possibly have seen this coming except everybody?
Except everybody.
Except everybody.
Exactly. Yep.
The whole planet.
Yep.
All right.
I mean,
anyway.
Yeah. It's not that they don't see it coming, right? It's priorities. I read this like wonderful thing one time that was like, when you find yourself saying, oh, I didn't have time to do something, what you should really say, you should change that language to, it wasn't a priority for me to do something.
Yeah, I made it.
And then when you hear yourself say out loud, it wasn't a priority for me to call my mom, or it wasn't a priority for me to take care of my health, or it wasn't a priority for me to find a way to rescue millions of Americans from starvation, poverty, or eviction, then you put your finger on what's really going on.
Right. Sorry, I chuckled that it wasn't a priority to call my mom, because my mom has begun just offloading like everything. And a 14-pound box showed up in the mail yesterday full of pictures of me and my brother and my dad and ancestors and this and that going back. I don't even know how far. She's like, here, I split this between you and your brother. I took care to make sure everybody got equal parts of the family in their pictures. And I'm like, all right, mom, thanks. So now I've got 5,000 pictures in my garage I have to go through.
I bet sub-story that everyone, I don't know about you, but I'm definitely talking to my mom a lot more.
Yeah.
Than
yeah,
I even sure. used to, for which sure. was already, yep. yeah. I'm like, yep. oh, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
the sidewalks and are literally, I'm trying to get rid of a couch. Can't do it. The sidewalks are literally littered with everybody's crap because everybody's got too much time to clean out their house. Oh, yeah. Oh, you don't so have funny. This going on? The sidewalks so boxes?
I don't know.
Oh,
I'm going to pay
God.
More attention.
My neighborhood is like... purging. Oh yeah, do it. You'll be like, oh, right. some glasses and a couch and some chairs and tables, and it's ridiculous. Okay, we're off topic.
All right, y'all
should we do the mailbag?
We should. We shall.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Kimberly and I did the Tuesday pod last week on voting and technology and fraud and how to do it and what a goat rope it is turning out to be this time. We spoke to Michael Alvarez. He's a Caltech at the Voter Something Something Project. And somebody's going to slack it to me and I'll get it before the end of this piece. But anyway, we asked him what he is worried about when it comes to this year's election. Levi Adams wanted to chime in and here's what he said.
Hi, Kai and Molly and Kimberly. This is Levi from New Brunswick, New Jersey. In your recent discussion about voter security, your expert stated that he believed our elections are actually pretty secure. And with the caveat that he's an expert and I'm just some schmo off the street, I have to say I don't feel the same way. I still will vote because I'm one of those people who votes even in off years when the races are for some assistant vice director of, I don't know, paperclip management or something. But the feeling that my voice is less likely to count this year has really greatly reduced my motivation to vote. And I really worry that many other Americans will feel the same way and just not vote at all. Thanks. Love the show.
Do not feel that way. Vote.
Because that's the
whole
plan.
Full stop.
Yep.
Do not. That's the whole plan. That is the whole freaking smash right there. Holy cow.
What you just said is exactly the goal. And Kimberly made that plain in your episode. She said, this is a form of voter suppression. Sowing doubt about an election and whether that election will be fair and whether it will be rigged is a form of voter suppression. It is a playbook.
Yep.
It happens all the time. It has been happening in this country for decades. It just happens to be even stronger over the last
nationwide,
4 years or so.
Yeah.
Nationwide. But Levi, all the more reason. Like, the more you feel that way, the more you need to make sure that you and your friends vote, because that is true. The goal is to get a lot of Americans to feel that way and not vote. Like, let's just say it plainly. That's the goal. Don't fall for it.
Let me make sure I get Michael Alvarez's ID right. He is he's at Caltech, and he runs the Caltech MIT Voting Technology Project. He's a professor of political science there. Yeah, vote. Don't do this whole, oh, my vote's not even going to count, you know.
Yeah.
So here's another quick mom story, right? And I know we're getting long in the tooth here, but on one of my recent conversations with my mother, she said, you know, Kai, I feel so strongly this election that I'm going to go stand in line to vote. And I'm like, Mom, you're an 80-year-old woman. You are not going to go stand in line to vote. So I spent some time online yesterday digging out the voter registrar information for her town and voter application ballot guides and all of that jazz and emailing it to her. There are ways to do this that will get you around the obstruction being put up by the defenestration of the United States Postal Service. Do not vote, if that makes any sense.
Right. And to be clear, like the U.S. Postal Service is just one of the many efforts. Every time someone tells you that this election is rigged or you can't trust the results, it is an attempt to get you to not vote. Like, understand that. I'm staring at the camera. Because understand that with crystal clarity. That's what's happening. Don't listen to it. Okay. Yep. Schools. On to schools. Man, it's starting too. Like, I'm just watching it on Twitter because you just, you know, the first days of school. Yeah. Are just rolling across this country. We have been talking, of course, about them reopening or going online in the fall. And something that keeps coming up, in fact, Oakland schools reopened and they said at least 15,000 students, I think, didn't have any internet access or devices. And that is the case across the country. I think we did some reporting that determined it's like 9 million. Anyway, our voicemail is going to give us even more numbers. We got a voice memo on this idea of the digital divide, the access to tech and internet, from Tom Allison, who works for the State Council of Higher Education in Virginia. They have been studying this issue, and here's what he sent in.
We conducted analysis here in Virginia using U.S. Census data to learn more about the students in the Commonwealth who lack these essential digital resources. And there are two quick tidbits I'd like to share. First, Black and Latino students in Virginia actually subscribe to broadband services at similar rates as white students. Where the divide emerges is with devices, computers and laptops. 18% of our African-American students and 15% of our Latino students don't have a computer in the home. For white students in the Commonwealth, it's half as much, 7%. So to address the digital divide along racial and ethnic lines, we need to think more about subsidizing devices. The other finding is the digital divide is both rural and an urban problem. In fact, if you look at all the students in Virginia that lack home broadband, 40% of them live in urban areas. Wow. So in thinking about ways to improve connectivity, it's not just about rural infrastructure. It's also about families who are unable to afford service despite having lots of provider options.
Yeah, it's bad. And let's make it clear, going back to school.
That whole 40% thing in urban areas is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I know. In our special, we talked a lot about, or a little bit about, digital redlining, broadband redlining.
Yeah.
I mean, access has been. We have, like with every part of this, it's historical trash piling up and putting us in this position. And going back to school isn't the solution either. Like, again, the one solution, get a handle on this thing.
Speaking of trash, see what I did there?
Oh!
We'll see what I did there in a second. Speaking of trash, we're going to go out not on a traditional make me smart question, but on something else we wanted to explore about this pandemic and the way it's affecting the society. And that is, and if you look around, you see it, right? Masks and gloves and stuff sort of on streets and in gutters and all those places. And that's, number one, not cool. But we talked about to a guy by the name of Mark Benfield. He's a professor of oceanography and coastal science at Louisiana State, about PPE waste in the environment. Here are some of his thoughts.
Every year, an estimated 8 million metric tons of plastic waste enters our oceans, where it disrupts marine ecosystems. With the pandemic, we've seen a surge in a new kind of plastic pollution, waste personal protective equipment, or PPE. I'm referring to discarded masks, gloves, and wipes. In April, I started a community science project in Baton Rouge to quantify waste PPE. From there, we now have volunteers collecting data in cities across the country, as well as in Canada, Turkey, Germany, Italy, and China. It's a simple concept that only requires a cell phone, and what we're learning is alarming. We each have a responsibility to protect ourselves and others, but we also have to protect the environment. So what can we do? This is one area where individuals have some real power. First, stop using gloves unless you have a specific medical need to do so. Wash and sanitize your hands on a regular basis instead. Get a cloth mask that can be washed and reused. Carry a Ziploc bag with you. When you need to dispose of PPE, put it in the bag, seal it, and put it in the trash when you get home. We have a big enough problem with existing plastic pollution. We don't need to compound it with a flood of PPE on our streets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, yes. Don't be the worst person in the world.
Yeah.
I mean.
That's right. Yes.
Jinx.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, come on.
And on that hopeful note, that is it for today's show.
Don't be the worst.
Check out our smart speaker. I mean, seriously.
Yes.
Check out our smart speaker explainers if you haven't already. Ask your Echo device to make me smart. Sign up for our newsletter online and send your questions for tomorrow. What do you want to know Wednesday? To make me smart at marketplace.org. Subject line questions. It is really like my favorite show. I love it. And we will see you then.
Boom.
Boom, indeed. Make Me Smart is produced and directed this week by Tony Wagner, also our digital producer. Ben Hethcote produces video with the help of our video intern, Ethan Peretz. And Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and smart speaker skill and like about a trillion other things at Marketplace.
Daniel Ramirez engineered today. Garrett Lang mixed the pod. Our theme music was composed by Daniel and Ben Talladay. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And there we go.
And there we go.
Another one in the can. Another one in the can. Yeah, what's interesting are the back-to-school tweets coming from teachers who are like, it sucks for us too, you know? And it totally does.
I know. 100%. Don't yell at teachers, everyone. I do also want to, like, because that is really, it's all being taken out on them. Also, I just ordered 8 reams of paper to distribute to various teachers because they're literally, like, they don't have any supplies.
You're a good soul.
I mean, it's, like, insane.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.